probably is something.
Yeah. Yeah, you're exactly what it is. It's not even just a popularity contest. It's just it's a big dumb game that makes no sense at all. There are each and every person knows it. They can try to deny it if they want, but there are such things as rights and wrongs. There's a moral law that is qualitatively above all men.
Yeah,
Aquinas refers to it as natural law. I would use that terminology as that much today, because then it would be confused with scientific natural laws. But yeah, Aquinas was the natural law that he went with, the laws written on our conscience. And what I would say though is you need something more than quantitatively adding more men, because you still get nothing qualitatively above man. So you still don't have the right to tell another man what to do or what not to do. So you need a moral law that is qualitatively above all men. How can one, if society makes the law, how can society call another society wrong? Only if there's a moral law qualitatively above all governments, so that we can judge whether or not this government is living up to it. So, and everybody does appeal to a moral law that is above all men. But the problem is, how do you get a moral law that is above all men, qualitatively above all men, unless you have a moral lawgiver that is above all men? Two kinds of laws. You can have a descriptive law, like the natural laws, where all we're doing is we describe the way nature usually acts. Like the law of gravity, these are natural laws. Generally, if you let go of a piece of chalk, it will fall to the floor. A natural law. So it's a descriptive. It doesn't prescribe anything. But then there's prescriptive laws. Well, whenever you make a moral value judgment, and pantheists and atheists do it as much as theists do, everybody does it. Whenever you judge the actions of somebody else, you are not appealing to a descriptive law. If the moral law is just a descriptive law, then all it does is describe how somebody acts. It doesn't prescribe how they should act or how they should not act. So when I say, Jeff, you did me wrong, I'm not talking about a descriptive law that he violated. I'm saying he violated a prescriptive law which prescribes how we should act. Well, the only time you get a prescriptive law is if there's a prescriptive mind, a mind that prescribed it. You get a prescription at the drugstore, you gotta have the doctor who prescribed it. So, if moral laws determine what should and should not be done, and if they are above men, and we all act like they are, then there's got to be a moral prescriber or a moral lawgiver above men. And you can have there's two reasons why people deny the absolute moral law. Some people just, they deny the absolute moral law because they just want to do their own thing, okay? Yeah, human economy. And others, and it's almost the same thing, but it's just their favorite or a little different aspect of it. Others want to deny the absolute moral law because they know it leads directly to the absolute moral lawgiver. So they really want to be able to say that some things are wrong, and to be able to control the behavior of others at the same time. They don't want to believe that God exists. So they always try to invent ways to come up with rights and wrongs without them being universal.
Then they find commentaries, one of the questions they ask them is, do you believe in natural law, which is a higher transcendent moral law? And he said he did. Most of the nobody else in the Supreme Court does.
Oh, really?
You really are?
Sure. Oh, well, you got it. The thing is, okay. Well, he and Scalia are the two most conservative. Clarence Thomas and Scalia are, so politically speaking, they would agree with us 99 out of 100 issues. But it might be, I think Scalia's Catholic too, though. But our founding fathers believed in natural law. Self-evident truth. That God had certain things that right and wrong, moral values that God had put in it, wrote them into nature that man could read from nature. But Aquinas held to it. The reformers held to it. And Thomas got it because he's a well-informed Catholic who has read on Aquinas. I would think Scalia would be well read enough to know what it was, but I'd be shocked to find out that Scalia doesn't hold to it himself. But what they were trying to slam him for, they were going to try to say his Catholicism, he's going to force Catholicism on everybody else. Natural law is not limited to Catholics. Both Catholics and the leading reformers held to it, and our founding fathers held to it, and you can't even have the same form of government that our founding fathers had without. And getting back to pantheism, also Francis Schaeffer argues that if personality exists in the universe, persons could not come from an impersonal cause. And, if man has an intellect, emotions, and a will, how could God have anything less? Okay? Even King David said in Psalm 94:9, he who made the eye, can he not see? He who formed the ear, can he not hear? He's not saying that God's got ears and eyes, but he's saying, surely, if the creation can do these beautiful things, God must at least be able to do those things, if not much more, much, much more. Then, of course, you can use scientific arguments for the beginning of the universe, energy deterioration, the Big Bang theory, and philosophical argumentation. You can't have an actual infinite number of events in time, moments in time, because you would never reach the present moment now. There had to be a first event, therefore, a first event in time, therefore there had to be the beginning of the universe, and if the universe had a beginning, it needs a cause, so therefore the universe is not God, it was caused by God, it's God's creation. The problem is that if this is a real serious pantheist, they could care less what scientific evidence or even the concept of time. If the universe is an illusion, time is an illusion too. So I think you'd be better off nailing them on the practical level and arguing that you deny the separate existence of of other beings. You say all reality is one being, yet you act like I exist separately from you, and you live like the physical universe does exist, and just go at it from more from that standpoint. I'm not going to touch on like a lot of New Age beliefs such as reincarnation and that type of thing. We're going to keep it more on the end. And their views about globalism and a one-world government. We'd be getting more into a specific type of pantheism and more into theology than philosophy of religion. All I'm saying is that at the outset, the new worldview called pantheism is deficient. A real popular view that is making a lot of noise today
was panentheism. Panentheism. It's a lot like pantheism, except that rather than God being the universe is God's body. God is the soul of the universe, okay? Alfred North Whitehead and Charles Hartshorn hold to this. It's also referred to as process theology. You'll hear a lot about this. There are a lot of evangelical scholars. You can't be a process theologian and be an evangelical. But there are a lot of evangelical scholars that are moving in the direction of process theology. None, of course, faster than Clark Pinnock. He's running full speed ahead. This view is that the universe is God's body. God has two poles. Now, they mean it differently than... When I talk about God having infinite potential, that's what he can do. But as far as God's being, God is pure actuality. He does not have the potential to not exist. And he does not exist as a possible, he's not a possible being. We are possible beings. We can possibly exist and possibly not exist. It was not necessary that we exist. God is a necessary being. He must exist. He cannot not exist. It's impossible for him to not exist. An impossible being is a being that's impossible to exist. That'd be like a square circle. Okay? A possible being would be like a unicorn or something. It may not exist, but it would be possible for there to be a horse with a horn on it. Okay? And there's no contradiction there. But God is a pure actual being in that he has no potential, no potentiality there when it comes to existence. He's not a possible being. He's pure actuality. I am that I am. His essence God's essence equals his existence. Now, all that means is essence is your definition, your nature, or what you are. Existence means that you are. So to say God's essence equals his existence is to say that what God is equal to that God is. Okay? The same thing as when God said to Moses from the burning bush, I am that I am. Okay? What man is not his existence. Okay? Our essence and our existence, I mean, God is a being. What God is the same as that God is. I don't want to get too far off here, but these guys, the process theologians, the panentheists, are using the actual potential poles. They're not talking about God's potential to do something. They're talking about God in his basic being as an actual pole and a potential pole. And they milk this to the point where it's crazy. The potential pole this is where the ontological argument comes in at. Because God, what God is, and his definition equals that he is. The ontological argument just argues that, really, that God, by definition, must exist. And we'll get into that, just like we did in philosophy. We'll probably spend more time on it in this course, and we'll probably confuse everybody real big on. I am still confused by that argument, but God's potential pole is infinite, they say, and eternal. Okay? And the pantheist says
that God's actual soul is finite and changing.
What's that? Yeah. There's
going to be all kinds of
logical
big kinds. Pantheism is a type of finite gods. They've got a limited God, but it's a limited / unlimited God. But obviously, that places limitations on God that a limited period God would not have. So it's a finite God. God and the world are interdependent. God needs the world as much as the world needs him. Process theologians teach the world is progressively getting better. Where in the world do they give the evidence that the world is getting progressively better? They teach that creation is a continual process of forming pre-existing matter. So they've got this eternal matter like Plato
that's real and real.
What's that?
Yeah, because, it's
more of out of God. That's another thing that's real similar with pantheism.
Well, now, if they've got, you said eternal matter? Well, doesn't that contradict their claim that God's actual being is finite? That God's actual physical being is the universe?
They got it finite, isn't it?
Me? We're gonna refute it here in
just a little while, but there are definite problems there, but they've got matter as eternal, but finite, limited, and it's changing, but there's always something there. Okay? But we'll get to it in just a second, because the fact that you have the actual and potential, it's impossible to have an infinite potential pull to a being that has a finite actual pull. We'll see that in just a couple of minutes here. So creation is a continual process of forming pre-existing matter. So God is not a creator, but he's the director of the world process, which is much like Plato's Demiurgos, where God was just the designer who designed the pre-existing matter that always existed. Okay. And then atheists reject the unchanging God of theism as not being personal enough. Okay. Because God doesn't change. He's saying if God doesn't change, you really can't have a personal relationship. A personal relationship is interdependent, there's a give and take, and in order for God to have this give and take to be personal, he can't be the unchanging God. And then we'll slam, these guys too will slam, and I'm starting to hear a lot of evangelicals talk this way now. And to get them to process the illusion, that's a cool thing to do now, that's a cool thing to be. And they'll slam your basic classical theists who hold to the same view of God that Aquinas and Augustine held to, and that the Reformers held to, they'll say, well, your guy's problem is you accepted
you accepted the view of reality from the Greek
philosophers.
And so it really wasn't a biblical view, it was a view that you drug out of Greek philosophy. And that basic view, about God being unchanging and then creating the universe, they on the other side of the coin, they choose to focus on the Heraclitus side of the Greek philosophers, where everything is in flux, everything is changing, okay? And what's more important than the things that are changing, the substances that are changing, is the change is the ultimate reality, not the substances. So it's almost like what's more important than Phil Fenn is the change, is the process that he's going through, and hence process reality, okay? Some Greeks focus on the change, the process, the change that was going on. Other Greeks focused on the substance that was going through the change. Well, we theists sided with the Greek philosophers that took one horn of the dilemma. So now the process theologians are slamming us for doing that. And what are they doing? Your view was Greek philosophers held to that. Well, big deal. You can find Greek philosophers for every deal, especially when there's a dilemma where you've got to choose one side or the other. You know, for every Aristotle, you're going to have Plato. For every philosopher that focuses on the universals, you got another one that focuses on the particulars. For every philosopher that focuses on the change, you can have somebody focusing on the substance that's going through the changes. For every Greek philosopher that focuses on the one, you can have another Greek philosopher focused on the many and the diversity. So, you know, that's just a dead complaint here. Evaluation of pantheism, panentheism, and process theism is that it's absurd for God to be both infinite and finite in his basic nature.
Yeah, except for the kenosis, I think you change the kenosis.
Yeah, well, that actually, and I dealt with this in my dissertation.
And this is why I said basic, in basic nature, with the kenosis doctrine teaching that Jesus is not both infinite and finite in his basic nature. In his basic nature, as God, he is infinite, but he added a human nature, so he has two natures. So in his divine nature, he's infinite, and his human nature, he is limited, he is finite. So, but these guys aren't saying that. They're saying God, in his basic nature, is both infinite and finite, and that's ludicrous. There you run smack into the law of non-contradiction. And something can't be both infinite and finite in the same way, in the same sense. That's basically what they're saying. Also, God is no longer sovereign. He is interdependent with the world. He depends on the world as much as the world depends on him. If these guys think that the world's getting better, it doesn't look that way. And they better hope that mankind starts evolving and getting better and better real quick. By the way, most of these guys are evolutionists, if not all of them, because evolution is this gradual change, this process that's going on. They love process, they love change. But God's no longer in charge. He's interdependent with the world, so why do you depend on him? But they tell us, dude, we got to work with God, kind of like Rabbi Harold Kushner and his finite God view. Also, though, if you have a coffee cup and it's sitting on the table, that coffee cup has the potential to fill itself with coffee. But it can't actualize its own potential there. Okay? No potential can actualize itself. Aristotle, he argued that clay does not mold itself into a statue. You need an actual sculptor to take the clay's potential and to actualize it. But with the panentheistic God, he's actualizing his own potential. And it makes no sense whatsoever. Geisler, in his book on worldviews, made a real good point where he said something along the lines
If this is, if there's only the potential, if the potential follows the eternal one, you know, let's say we just said, well, the actual pole was eternal, and it actualized the potential pole's potential to be actualized, okay? Versus, I have the potential to exist, but I could not actualize my own existence. A being that already actually existed had to actualize my existence. Okay? See what I'm getting at? But if you got, if your potential pole is the eternal pole, you can run into a real problem, because without the actual, without something actual to actualize that potential, you know, it's not going to come about. And it goes right back to the Aristotle saying that clay doesn't mold itself into a statue. An actual being has to come over there and use the potential that the clay has and mold it. So I advise you to argue something along the lines that if the actual is eternal, then it can actualize the potential to exist. But if the potential pole is eternal, which is what the pantheists are saying, there's nothing actual to actualize its potential. So instead of like two horns to a dilemma, you accept one horn, you end up with Christian deism. You accept the other horn, you're in pantheism, but it makes no sense whatsoever. And so it's just a ludicrous view. You can argue from science with these guys that the universe had a beginning, but I think we're going to be running out of time on that. These new agers. Science has to be dominated by a religion. Because you have to make certain religious presuppositions before you make your rules, the rules of your game called science. Christian theists started modern science because they believed the reasonable God created the universe in reasonable ways so that through reason they had to find out about the elements of the universe in which he lived. Then it was taken over by the atheists, so they started changing the rules a little bit. What it was they just took out the a priori presupposition that God exists, but then why should we expect things to make sense if there's no reasonable God? But the thing is, now we're going in a new age direction. In quantum physics and stuff, there's a lot of guys that they're starting to discover things, and they're starting to discover that this solid gas isn't as solid as it looks to us. There's more open space in between the molecules there than they ever would have imagined.
There's more open space, but none.
Yeah. And so, you know, things are starting to start, some guys are starting to argue that things are happening without a cause on the quantum level, which isn't the case, but that's what they're arguing. And so the basic presuppositions that science is based upon are folding. And I think we're going to end up with a science that is nothing but New Age, expansion of New Age religion.
So suppose the smaller, if quantum physics finds itself then of every time it creates a theory, it has to talk about 18 new particles and discovers two of them and 2 million and it's missing, and it's just becoming a hopeless mess. Is that because the basic assumption that a reasonable God put the universe together in a reasonable fashion is no longer there, so they're no longer finding a reasonable,
I don't want to make this into a philosophy of science class, but I will say this. There are a lot of connections between science and magic. That's why sometimes, yeah, an awful lot, and then this has been documented too, like plenty of stuff. That's why a lot of times, occultic systems turn out stuff that was like acupuncture. Yeah. Acupuncture is based on the life force in the body, a new age, a pantheistic view, religious view, but there are certain principles in there that work. You can find shamans and witch doctors casting spells, doing this and doing that, but sometimes when you eat the plant, they tell you to eat to cure a certain illness, it actually does work. Well, some scholars are arguing that modern science wouldn't hard to argue along these lines. It's just they're modern witch doctors, but some of the things they stumble onto do work. But the thing that science has very much in common with magic is they both start out as an attempt to master creation and to get the creation work to work for us. Okay? Now, God gave man dominion over the earth, and he lost a certain portion of that dominion in the garden. So mastering the universe isn't that big. But what I'm getting at is they start out almost synonymous. And if your religious beliefs are out to lunch, then you're going to probably end up synonymous. And what's happened is we started modern science based on the belief in the biblical God, and it made sense. Then scientists threw out that belief, but all the evidence just kept pointing right back in that direction. But they didn't like it, so they rejected those conclusions and wanted different conclusions. But they couldn't find any. So now they're desperately looking for non-theistic conclusions in a theistic universe. So I think the science of the next 20, 30, 40 years is going to be a science that doesn't focus on the clear theistic evidences, Big Bang model, the first and second laws of thermodynamics, or law of biogenesis, but instead focuses more on the unknown realms of the universe, the things that are less proven, the new areas that we're exploring, such as outer space, quantum mechanics, because there it's open to more speculation, and you won't get the theistic conclusion for another 150 years. But the thing is, those things blow atheism right out of the water. Where does atheism go in science? Atheism says man is the measure. Man can master this creation. Technology is going to lead us to the point where we're going to put an end to war. We're going to put an end to sickness. We're going to put an end to evil. We're going to evolve to the point where we're going to have a perfect utopia. We're going to put an end to death. We're going to cure death. That's where atheism leads. Man replaces God. Well, now we're going to be going in the exact opposite direction, and so I think pantheism is going to be for man to act like he has no presuppositions and no biases, and he's just an objective observer of evidences. Man's lying to himself, and so I think we're going to be starting with the false presuppositions there. Anyway, a couple other problems with process theism. The world does not seem to be getting better. Okay, all the evidence seems to indicate it's getting worse. Before World War I, we had a bunch of liberal theologians saying that we're reaching the evolving beyond the point of war, there wasn't going to be any more wars, and we're going to live in peace, and this is the millennial kingdom, and Jesus isn't going to return until after it's over, and we're going to have peace on earth. Then came World War I. So they called World War I the war to end all wars. Before the 1940s, theologians again started moving in that direction. Then came World War II. Now when we find theologians apostatizing the faith, and start talking about man finding peace without God on this planet and the world getting better, we're probably going to find World War III right around the corner. But the world does not seem to be getting better. Also, the God of panentheism cannot guarantee the defeat of evil. He's limited in any way. He can't guarantee the defeat of evil. And therefore, why worship a finite, a limited, non-sovereign God?
Since the God of pantheism is changing, doesn't that mean that, depending on your view of the nature of good, whether it's good because God loves it or God loves it because good, actually, either case, since God is changing, the relationship between good and evil will change. because...
Well, these guys would argue, I think pantheism is so filled with wishful thinking, I'm just shocked that they would admit that. And it's actually, there are pantheists that are very compatible with the new, like Matthew Fox, the former Catholic scholar in the Blue Island Catholic Church. He's a pantheist, but New Agers love his stuff. But it's like wishful thinking. I think it's more a case of the intelligent man throwing his brains out the window than anything else. But because it's changing, but it's all getting better. But it's like, if everything is changing, how can you have any absolute, concept of what good is and what evil is?
Well,
so you could,
not only that, but if you consider the direction in which things are going as a, say, a characteristic of the universe, well, if everything's changing, then that's changing too, and eventually we won't be getting better, we'll be getting worse again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, it's a light, it's a leap of a lot of faith that it's getting better. And again, evolution is tied into this view.
They're all
at evolution.
Yeah.
We used to be monkeys, so we're doing better now. And but you need those absolutes, those unchanging universals, even to make a statement that there is such a thing as good or evil. And they really don't have it. And so why worship a finite, non-sovereign God? Now we discussed atheism, pantheism, and panentheism. We'll give arguments for God's existence in future lectures. But I want to talk about finite Godism. Finite Godism, the belief that God is limited. Remember, we discussed that there could be belief in one finite God. There could be belief in many, which would be polytheism. And then henotheism would believe that one of those gods is supreme. Plato's Demiurgos was a limited God who did not create the material universe, but designed it, formed it, but it was pre-existing matter. Aristotle had 47 or 55 different unmoved movers in his thought. It seemed, though, to settle on one unmoved mover behind them. But the finite God is limited in either power or goodness or both, due to the existence of evil. In other words, if God was all good, well, then he would want to destroy evil. He's all-powerful. He could destroy evil, but evil still exists. Therefore, God either isn't all-good or isn't all-powerful. That's the way they would argue. Rabbi Harold Kushner, in his book, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People, someday will order his debate on John Eckenberg's show with Geisler, six half-hour segments to that debate. But he argues in his book, which I bought at the Christian bookstore, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
I told him to get it off the shelves, and they won't listen to Fernandez. Where's Fernandez? No, he's just a dumb half Italian, half 40 from New Jersey. Sort of right there, Rabbi Harold Kushner saying we need to pray for God and forgive him.
To whom are we praying?
And we need to forgive him. And what he actually in that book recommends that we pray because it makes us feel better. Yeah, so it kind of implies that prayer is bouncing off the wall because God might be a little deaf too. But anyway, we need to forgive God for his failures and we need to help him to defeat evil because he can't do it without us. That's Rabbi Harold Kushner. We'll get those. That's the kindest I've ever seen guys in a debate, because Kushner starts out that debate with his 14-year-old teenage son died of a tragic death.
Yeah.
And he just could not believe that that was God's will, so he believes it's something God could not prevent, therefore that is no problem. So guys were very compassionate in that, but usually guys were he's going for the jugular vein 2 minutes before the debate starts. Yeah. And
We must aid God if evil is to be defeated, Rabbi Aaron Kushner argues. Now, we'll deal with the problem of evil later on, because evil does not prove a finite God. Evil does not prove a limited God. You can have an all-powerful, all-good God who allows evil for the purpose of a greater good, and after good is evil has served his purpose, he will then defeat evil, which is what the Bible says. You know, atheists act like, you know, they're going to walk up and say, I know your God doesn't exist, but it is because of the existence of evil, the problem of evil. You know, they're going to act like we're supposed to go, oh, no, oh, man, evil. Boy, they caught me unexpectedly. You know, 6,000, or the Bible was written 2,000 years ago, and we just never thought about the issue. No. Why would God write the Bible if it wasn't for the existence of evil? The whole Bible is in response to the problem of evil. If man didn't fall in the garden, there wouldn't be any evil. If there wasn't any evil, there wouldn't be a need for a Savior. Why did second person of the Trinity become a man, die on a cross for our sins, rise from the dead, promise to return? Why did God decide to prepare hell for Satan's demons? All these things are part of God's response to the problem of evil. And so Christianity is. A Christian faith is the solution to the problem of evil. You could actually answer the problem of evil in one word. We'll spend two lectures on it. You can answer in one word. Jesus. He is the answer to the problem of evil. But anyway, the finite God is, if God is limited to either power or goodness or both, due to the existence of evil is their view. Number one, if there's a finite, limited God, okay, then that finite, limited God would need a cause. Eventually, you've got to have some unlimited being to ground the existence of all limited existence, okay? There's no way you can have a less than infinite being exist throughout all eternity. Because only an infinite being that is unlimited in its power is going to be able, you know, if it's finite, if it's limited, then that would seem to entail the possibility of non-existence. That would seem to entail there, since unlimited, there's some circumstance that could occur that I'm not going to be able to handle that could destroy me. And only an infinite, unlimited God, unlimited being, with no potential for non-existence whatsoever, could classify as an eternal being and classify as the source for all finite existence. So even a finite God would need a cause. Also, a finite God cannot guarantee victory over evil, so why trust in him? Well, why worship him? And we already mentioned evil does not prove a finite God. Now, I mentioned that one type of finite Godism is polytheism, and I want to respond to that. There cannot be more than one God. Number one, there has to be some infinite existence that is the ground of all finite existence. Limited existence, contingent existence, has the possibility for non-existence. And therefore there has to be something, some necessary being that grounds our existence and keeps us in existence. Okay? So, number one, there has to be an infinite God, an infinite being, grounded just in everything else. So suppose somebody says, well, okay, so God is infinite, but what if I believe there's many infinite gods? That's something you cannot have. There has to be only one infinite God, because if God is infinite, infinite means unlimited, if God is infinite, that means he would have to have all
perfections that would be possible for a being to have, God would have to have all of them. So there's unlimited perfections, and he has to have each one of them in an unlimited way. Well, the thing is, you couldn't have two infinite beings, because to be for one, for there to be two different beings, they would have to differ on something. And if both beings were infinite, they would both have the same exact perfections, and they would both have the same exact perfections in the same exact degree. They would both have an infinite. For one being to differ from another being, one would either have to lack something that the other one had, or it would have to have something that the other one lacked. But then, if one being has something the other one doesn't have, then the other one's not at the infinite. And if this being lacks something that the other one has, that being can't be infinite. So there can only be one infinite being. A lot of this goes right back to Parmenides' argument about pure being. There can only be one pure, infinite, unlimited being. If there were two infinite beings, they would be limited because they could both arm wrestle each other to a draw. Okay? They would limit one another's existence. But then they wouldn't be unlimited. Because to be infinite, you've got to be unlimited. So there could only be one infinite being. There has to be at least one infinite being to ground the existence of all finite existence. And then there cannot be more than one infinite being. So what does that tell us? There's only one God. And we'll go into the argument.